This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, MIBiz staff writer Nick Manis tells us how economic development officials in Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo are thinking about rail service. And he has an update on efforts to close the so-called dark store tax loophole. But first,
this year, WMUK is celebrating its 65th anniversary. It went on the air in 1951 as WMCR, broadcasting 400 watts at 91.1 FM. Over the years, there would be a stronger signal, a new place on the FM dial, and membership in something called National Public Radio. WMUK will hold a celebration Wednesday at Bell's to honor 65 years of broadcasting. We're going to discuss some of that history with a man who saw a lot of it. Gerard McLeod worked for 40 years for this station, 30 of them as general manager. Gerard McLeod, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Oh, well, thank you very much for inviting an old codger to back to the radio station. It's wonderful to be here.
When did you start working at WMCR?
Well, actually, I started working at WMCR when I was a student at Western. And I don't know the exact year, but probably around 1955 or something like that. And I worked off and on as a student until about 1959. And in 1959, the manager at the time was a guy named Bob Dye. And he wanted to get the radio station on regular hours all year long. Up until that time, we had been on the air like 8 or 10 hours a day, but not on any weekends. And we would sign off in the summertime when summer school started, because there were no students around much to help out at the radio station.
So sign off for like 3 months.
They sign off for like 3 months. Okay. Yeah, right. And this wasn't unusual for educational non-commercial stations, as we were then called in those days. And they decided that they wanted a full-time announcer so that there would be somebody there all year. And basically, I think what they did was they pooled a lot of the student help money and came up with one salary with fringe benefits. And I don't remember how much I made in those days, but it wasn't a lot. And it was a great opportunity for me because I was working at the time at WKZO when it was still Fetzer Broadcasting as a news person. And I was working more or less full-time but getting paid part-time rates and no fringe benefits or anything. And I had just gotten married, so this was a great opportunity to have a more or less stable job.
So how did you end up becoming general manager eventually?
I worked full-time from 1959 until 1969. And somewhere in like the earlier 60s, Western had started a closed-circuit television operation that was in the basement of Waldo Library, kind of next door to Maybe Music Hall, which is where our original studios were. And that building is now totally gone. We had this television operation, and I was working part-time as a television director, was closed circuit to broadcast general studies and humanities-type programs into big classrooms with television monitors. But I didn't really like that much. And so I finally, they gave me a choice. I could either stay working in television or it was driving me nuts kind of going back and forth between radio and television. And so I chose radio, and it turned out to be a good choice for me.
Gerard McLeod continued working for the station over the next 10 years and was named program director for what had by then become WMUK. But in 1969, there was a reorganization. Glenn Bishop, who had been station manager, was named associate director of technical services.
At the same time they had this meeting, I was totally surprised. They just announced that I was going to be the station manager. And it was kind of a shock to all of us, but it worked out, you know, and it was lovely for me. Although at first I had no clue as to what I was supposed to be doing. Glenn had these wonderful relationships with the you know, people in the administration over there, in the financial part of the administration, dealing with budgets and all that stuff. I didn't know anything about that. It was not my job at the time, but I learned. It turned out, Gordon, to be it was a stroke of luck, you know, for me, because right about that time, this was 1969 when I was named manager. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting had been founded in 1967. Lyndon Johnson had signed the bill that established that. And something called public radio was just beginning. They were just beginning to talk about it in 69 when I became manager. And I remember going to a meeting where they were trying to figure out what stations needed if they were to get this thing off the ground, to establish an interconnected group of stations all across the country. What was it educational stations needed most? Well, the answer was we needed a good, reliable source of competent news and public affairs. In addition to, you know, the arts-oriented and humanities-oriented things that we all did kind of traditionally.
And so this is where NPR starts to really get its roots and start to take off.
Yes, right. And the original NPR was funded entirely by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And the corporation, the other thing the corporation had was what they called community service grants, which I think they still do for stations, that were designed to help stations build their staff or their facilities and that sort of thing to become more viable operations.
And this is how WMUK ended up really getting into local news, was with one of these grants, correct?
That's right. The original grant that we got from the community service grant we got from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, I think it was like $8,500. And that's a tremendous amount of money at the time for us. And it was enough money to establish a new full-time news position, first one we'd ever had, and to pay the fringe benefits on it. And the nice thing about it, the university jumped at it, of course, because it was going to be an ongoing grant. You just had to renew it every year. The first public affairs director we had was a guy I knew through the theater here in Kalamazoo. We'd been in some shows together. And his name was Fritz Frurip, and he was the first public affairs director. And he was with us. Well, this was when we were up in Mabee Hall still. He was with us for, I guess, about 2 years, 2 or 3 years. And then in 1973, so we hired Tony Griffin.
Tony Griffin, who hired me and hired Andy Robbins eventually.
That's right. And Tony was a great hire because he had talents and abilities beyond his news-gathering strengths, which were formidable, but he was also a great ambassador out in the community for us. And he personally kind of made people aware of WMUK that weren't aware of before, especially people in, you know, county and state government. He had all the county and state government people in for his News Views programs that he established early on, right around 1973, when we first moved into this building in 1973.
So if you look back at the time you were here, we'll just take it up to your retirement, which was 1999, what would you say were the biggest changes in terms of how the radio station operated and maybe how the radio station interacted with the community?
That's kind of a multifaceted question.
I suppose it is. More than one question in
there. Yeah, right. Well, let's see. During my time with the radio station, one of the first things we did, and this was when Glenn was manager, because he was interested in doing really good recordings of classical music and things. And there was a guy named Gregory Millar who came to be a conductor of the Kalamazoo Symphony. back in the 60s sometime. And the Kalamazoo Symphony was interested in having us record and rebroadcast their concerts. And Glenn was really eager to do this because he loved doing that kind of stuff and was very good at it. And the symphony played at the time down in Chenery Auditorium. And so we developed that. We recorded their concerts, and they were usually in the middle of the week, sometime like Tuesdays, I think. And we played them back on Friday nights. And then that expanded into doing the Chamber Music Society. Fontana hadn't arrived yet, but the Kalamazoo Concert Band and the Junior Symphony and the Bach Festival. We did all of those concerts. And so that was one of our first things where we ventured into the community and tried to serve at least the musical community in Kalamazoo. And, you know, I remember doing all those concerts. It was a lot of fun. Well, then, of course, this is the programming side. The coming of NPR was another big moment. And incidentally, the original yearly cost to the stations for NPR was $100 a year.
Oh, boy.
But that was because it was pretty much subsidized by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I think the current general manager just fainted here.
I left, it was well over $100,000 a year.
And it keeps going up.
Yeah. Anyway, so NPR, and then when we got our own newsman and Tony Griffin, well, you know, Tony was important, but even more important was the fact that we had the position on board. And it was a position that had a stable funding. Well, then when NPR went into stereo, so those are kind of the things on the programming side. There were a lot of other little things, but those are major ones. And then there was on the technical side, you mentioned, you know, we were at 91.1 with 400 watts.
Yeah.
And then in 1955... we got a grant from the Kellogg Foundation over in Battle Creek. There was a station in Battle Creek that had an FM station, AM and an FM station, WELL. And they had decided to get out of FM broadcasting because they couldn't sell any advertising on it. And they were at 102.1. And they were licensed as a Class B station, which I think is now called a Class B station, and at 50,000 watts effective radiated power. So they sold under this grant for like $7,500, I think it was. They sold us their antenna, the transmitter, this big old Western Electric transmitter, which was an awesome transmitter, and also gave us the frequency.
So when you look at the time from when you started, I don't know if you want to take it from when you were a student or when you started full time, and you look at through your time as general manager and then even beyond that, because you've stayed in the area, you've still done work for us occasionally. What do you see as the things which have remained constant? How is WMUK still in many ways the same place it was back when you were general manager?
Well, one thing that has remained constant is our involvement in the arts and humanities community here. We've changed the way we present classical music, local classical music on the station. We used to broadcast complete concerts, like of the Kalamazoo Symphony, as if we were at the concerts. Well, we actually were, but it was a tape recording of them. And now we broadcast, often we broadcast the whole concert, but it will be in the context of a piece from the Kalamazoo Symphony concert and a piece on Kara's program, Hear It, a piece from Fontana or something like that, which makes, in some ways, much more interesting listening, I think.
And then interviews mixed in.
We used to do an interview with the Kalamazoo Symphony at the intermission in the Kalamazoo Symphony with a soloist or or the conductor or whatever. But we're still very much involved in all these local music organizations. I mean, I see Martin Clam out, you know, even at rock concerts.
Yes. Yeah.
I see him. And so that's one constant. It was some stations have just completely given up on classical music and present mainly news and information. And of course, news and information is important, but the mix we have here, I think, is a really good one. And it, you know, it gives us an identity in this area. Another thing that's remained remarkably constant at this station is the staff. Over the years, I mean, except for retirements, over the years, the staff has been remarkably constant. I mean, you, Mark Tomlinson, Jack, Kara, who else?
Clay
Woodworth, of course, yeah.
Andy Robbins.
Andy, and Martin, came in a little later, but he's been here a number of years now.
12, 13,
yeah,
something like
right.
that. Yeah.
The staff has been remarkably constant, and they're all really good, you know? you're all really good. And I like to think that reflects well on me or on Floyd or somebody, you know, who managed to con you people into working here. But it's a wonderful, you have a wonderful staff here, and you've picked up since I retired, you have several new people here that are really, really very good. And Gordon Bolar, who is the station manager, who is about to retire,
yep.
But but Gordon told me he's been here about 10 years. I couldn't believe how fast 10 years, that 10 years went by. But Gordon had a background in public broadcasting. And he took over for Floyd and Floyd Pienka. So we've had a lot of really good people here, and that's been a constant that I think has served us well, too.
Well, Gerard, you are certainly among the good people we have had here over the years. Thank you very much for coming back in. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you, Gordon. Thank you.
Gerard McLeod was WMUK's general manager for 30 years. He served the station for more than 40 years as an employee. WMUK will celebrate its 65th anniversary on Wednesday with an event at Bell's. You can find details at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Train travel between Kalamazoo and Chicago is supposed to get faster in the near future. That has got the attention of economic developers in Grand Rapids, who wonder if trains out of their city can be rerouted to Kalamazoo to take advantage of rail infrastructure improvements. Nick Manis wrote about this recently for MIBiz. Nick Manis, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me on, Gordon. I appreciate it, as always.
So what got the people at, for instance, the Right Place Economic Development Agency in Grand Rapids even talking about the idea that rail routes could perhaps be changed?
Sure. I think it's something that they're at least looking at. It's certainly something further in the future, but they see opportunity. I've spoken with Rick Chaplow, who's their vice president of strategic initiatives there. And he says that that Chicago really is the economic engine for this Midwestern region that the Grand Rapids is part of, and that by just, you know, anything we can do to enhance mobility between the two areas makes a big difference for business and the overall economy.
And they're looking at the improvements that are supposed to allow trains to travel up to 110 miles an hour. And seeing basically as something that they would like to be able to route their passengers down there to take advantage of it?
Yeah, right now, they don't, Grand Rapids, Chicago, Amtrak only runs one train each way every day. I believe there's four from Kalamazoo to Chicago. So just greater connections, greater speed, and greater mobility. That's very appealing to economic development, not just in Grand Rapids, but in the Kalamazoo area as well.
And then you talked to some people with Southwest Michigan First here in Kalamazoo. What are their thoughts?
Yeah, they, they see this as an opportunity. And they said this before, and I think we had my business previously written about this to some extent, that they increasingly see themselves as, something of a suburb or a bedroom community to the Chicago area. You know, in faster and enhanced train travel only makes that more realistic, at least as they see it. It might not be Kalamazoo, the city specifically, but they see other cities in the region, as you go west, like Baton Harbor and stuff, is increasingly being part of the Chicago area.
Now, before anyone gets too far ahead of themselves thinking that this is all going to happen tomorrow, you do quote an official from the Michigan Department of Transportation saying that while this has been discussed, it isn't a priority, is the quote in your story. So
Give
us an idea here. How serious really are the discussions?
He says that they've certainly discussed it. I think right now they're more focused on completing the infrastructure work that will connect, that will make it possible for trains between Detroit and Chicago to travel 110 miles an hour the entire time. I think they say that will get travel times between Detroit and Chicago down to 3.5 hours or so, maybe 4 hours. Compared with, I think even, 5 to 5.5 hours to drive if you get it without traffic.
So has anyone who has been discussing this idea of sending trains from Grand Rapids to Kalamazoo even begun to consider things like cost or the logistics of how you would get passengers into a train station, which currently doesn't have any tracks running north and south near it at the moment?
Right. And, I think that's definitely, the concern why, at least nothing formal is being talked about here. It's just, the cost and the logistics of it are quite unknown at this point. So at this point, I think it's fair to say it's an idea, and people are very interested in the idea, but I don't think it's a whole lot more than that right now.
So does the fact that these ideas are even being floated, even if they're still at the very early stages at best, does it indicate that people who are at economic development agencies like Southwest Michigan First or the right place in Grand Rapids, really looking at investment in rail service as a serious consideration in the future?
Sure. I think, as we talked about, I think just the idea of mobility of all kinds, with travel from the right place, at the same time they talked about this being something that should be a priority. He talked about Southwest Airlines' recent decision to begin flying planes from Grand Rapids to Midway Airport in Chicago, which is Southwest Airlines' biggest hub. So once again, just, as they see it, it's really all about mobility options. And, that's going to be trains, that's going to be airplanes and everything in between.
And so in the minds of someone at the right place, adding a north-south line between Grand Rapids and Chicago is not necessarily instead of the cross-state passenger rail system, which you mentioned in your story, proposed from Holland to Detroit.
Right, and I think that's still being discussed, but nobody would go into any specifics about that. As far as I know, they haven't even finalized a route yet. They just know that it would go. Any proposal would go from Holland to Detroit, presumably. But they're still kicking around a couple of different options to where it would stop in between. So, I think they have to at least work out those logistics somewhat before they would even move forward with further plans. I know I believe the Detroit News has reported that it would be a profitable line from the studies that they've done at least so far.
Well, on another subject, the last time we talked with you was back in the summer about something called the dark stores theory, which was allowing retailers to get their property tax bills lowered on, for instance, big box retail stores. Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about this before we get an update and kind of remind our listeners who might have forgotten about it, or perhaps let listeners know who didn't get to hear that first interview, exactly how this loophole works.
Sure. It's a loophole that, a store like a Meijer or a Walmart or a Home Depot, or in some cases, sources inform me that even gas stations and smaller convenience stores are also using this. But essentially, they get the property tax bill. They immediately appeal it to a group called the Michigan Tax Tribunal, saying that that their tax bill is too high and that it should be based on comparable stores, as they refer to it, which are often closed vacant stores. And so far, the Michigan Tax Tribunal has largely agreed with the retailers over the objections of many many municipalities and municipal organizations that lobby on their behalf.
And this has taken a bite out of the budgets of local governments across the state, correct?
It absolutely has. The Michigan Association of Counties, I believe, estimates that just since 2013, it cost municipalities in the state about $100 million.
And then there are sometimes deed restrictions in place on some of these properties, so that doesn't leave a lot of options for redeveloping them.
Right. You know, these organizations such as the Michigan Association of Counties and Michigan Municipal League that are lobbying to close this loophole, love to show photos of, vacant stores that have long been vacant in places around the state that just can't be redeveloped because they have deed restrictions placed on them by the retailers, essentially, that say that any sort of competing use just can't be on that property.
So what are lawmakers in Lansing at least proposing that might be done about this?
Right. So State Rep David Maturin, a Republican from Kalamazoo County, has introduced House Bill 5578 that he sees as being the right bill to really help curtail this practice. He's a former real estate appraiser, and he sees opportunity to what he says is level the playing field. Essentially, all properties would be treated equal under this bill. So, it really wouldn't allow for these retailers to try to claim, that their buildings are special.
So, in your story, State Representative Dave Maturin says that he has 27 co-sponsors for his bill. So, does this indicate that there are other lawmakers out there, and it's bipartisan support, that see this as a problem in their communities?
Yeah, I think they absolutely do. And Rep. Maturin is not the first legislator to introduce legislation aimed at curtailing or closing this loophole. He says his legislation stands out as being a little bit more all-encompassing and, looking at it from a real estate appraisal issue and treating all property the same as opposed to other bills which move forward. But I don't think that's not saying that he also doesn't see, some problems going forward. I think he sees it as the industry itself, the retailing industry will move to fight this. Haven't seen examples of that yet, but I think that's something to pay attention to.
So despite broad bipartisan support in the legislature, Representative Maturin thinks that he's in for a bit of a battle on this one?
That's more or less what he indicated. I think as I wrote in my story, he says the folks that get this treatment will be adamant in keeping it. And I don't think it will be quick and easy, is his quote. I think it's worth mentioning that I've also reached out to the Commercial Real Estate Association for the area, and they're still examining the legislation as well. They've been interested in seeing where legislation will go with this, but they've yet to take a position on it.
Nick Manis, again, thank you for your time.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Gordon. I appreciate you having me on.
Nick Manis is a staff writer for MIBiz. You can find links to his stories on train travel between Kalamazoo and Chicago, as well as the dark store theory used to get favorable tax treatment by retailers in Michigan at MIBiz.com and through a link at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.